This is the Aftermarket Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of Business by the Numbers. I'm your host, Hunt Demarest, CPA with Parham Ellison Associates. As I have teased for the last couple weeks, the mailbox episode is here where I go through some of the most common and best questions that I've received over the last couple weeks. As a reminder, if you want to hear a topic discussed on the podcast, or if you just have a question, either a follow-up to an episode I've already done, I get that a lot. Hey, you talked about this, this, and this. My situation's slightly different. Still the same advice or different. Or if you just have something that, hey, you haven't heard me talk about before. I always take time to answer your questions. Every single listener that has sent a question in, I will always give you an answer back. Some of those I end up using on episodes. Some of them are obviously a little bit too private or too specific where they might not be applicable. But seriously, if you're wondering that, I bet you someone else is too. Get it in here and I will get it out to the people that need it. Don't be shy. Shoot me a message at podcast@parmalis.com and your question might be on the next episode. As I record this, the government shutdown has been averted. I'm recording this actually on Saturday. Government, I think, shut down for a couple minutes or something because they weren't able to pass this till like midnight or something last night. And like I've kind of done the last couple of weeks, I was almost going to jump over this mailbox and talk about the new budget, the $1.2 trillion budget deal that was passed. But we don't really have all the details out of it. I mean, it's like 1,000 pages. So a lot of that will take a couple days, even weeks, to kind of have people process and analyze. And I didn't really see much of note in there. Now, for those of you with gas stoves, I kind of laughed when I saw this. It's, man, what a snapshot of what is so wrong with our country, of what these guys are worried about. But the ban on gas stoves has been banned. So they're no longer allowed to take away the gas stoves. I'm not sure why they're trying to do that. I think it's something to do with global warming. I don't know. If gas stoves are really what's putting us over the edge, then God help us. But yeah, rejoice. We still have a government, even though maybe shutting them down and trying to get some new ones might have been helpful, but enough of that. Let's get into these questions. Before we get into that, as always, I want to thank you for being a dedicated listener. I want to thank you for sharing these episodes with people you think could benefit. Thank you for the kind words, and also thank you for these awesome questions that we are about to talk about here in a second. Lastly, we cannot forget our dedicated sponsors, NapaTracks and Promotive, for being loyal supporters of the show. Support the people that support the industry. If you need a new shop management software or some new team members, make sure to give them a call and tell them Hunt sent you. Hey, did you know NapaTracks has on-site training plus 6 days a week support? It all starts when a local representative meets you to learn more about your business and how you run it. After all, it's your shop, so it's your choice. Let us prove to you that Trax is the single best shop management system in the business. Visit them online at napatrax.com. That's NAPATRACS.com. Are you tired of writing ads that don't generate one good candidate? Introducing Promotive, a full-service staffing solution for your auto repair shop. Go beyond the job boards and let them find your next rock star. They do all the heavy lifting for you. Visit them online at gopromotive.com. The time has come. Let's get into these questions. And this is not like a comedian that says, hey, these are true stories. These are real true stories. And I was going to consolidate the questions or the emails from people, but I think it sounds even more authentic. And for some of these ones, it gives you a little bit of a backstory. This first one I'm going to do is hands down the most common question that I get. I chose one of these emails. I have about 10 of them worded slightly differently than I could use, but this one's kind of clean and concise, but I will add in some other aspects that this listener did not ask that other people did. Let's get into question number one from Alex in Pennsylvania. Hunt, I have been listening to your podcast over the last few months, and I found it to be very enjoyable and informative. Thank you, Alex. In response to your request for podcast topics, I believe that I have one that would benefit many independent shop owners. I would agree, Alex, and I think this would benefit pretty much anyone that is self-employed, not just shop owners and not just independent shop owners. So here is his question. How do I pay myself? What is the right mix between salary wages and corporate dividends, considering that the two are taxed differently? I posed this question to my 20 group last year, and the answers were wide-ranging and inconclusive. Thanks, Alex in Pennsylvania. First and foremost, thank you, Alex. Alex has already got the answer to his question, so he might even not listen to this one and skip to the next one. But Alex, if you're listening, we're going to add a couple more details to this that probably are pertinent. The whole idea behind distributions, what mix should be distributions, what should be payroll, and everything else in between is the most common question from listeners, from my current clients. It's really one of the trickiest ones because it's not super easy to oversimplify this, right? Everyone's a little bit different. But then the other aspect, more or less, most people kind of fall under the same rules. Like I said, I'm going to have a follow-up thing on this one because there was one aspect that was not included in this email that I want to talk about. But let's just talk about Alex's question here. Everyone knows that most businesses can decide to pay their people in the form of payroll and also distribution. Is it good if you take all distributions? Probably not. Is it good if you take all payroll? Probably not either. Now, where this gets a little bit tricky is the type of business that you are. And so I'm going to quickly kind of go down through the four major types of entity or entity structure that you might have, because all of those are a little bit different. Three of these are fairly easy because you don't have as much flexibility. And then one of them is where these questions arise. Let's go into the four different types of entities that you can be. Now, I'm not talking about LLC versus corporation. I'm talking about what kind of tax return you actually file. Because even though you're an LLC, that doesn't really dictate how you're going to be taxed. You have options here. Starting with the most simple, and that is what's called a sole proprietor. So if you're a sole proprietor, you could be an LLC, you could be not even a business at all. You could be running your social security number. How do you know if you're a sole proprietor? Sole proprietor does not file a separate tax return. If you are a sole proprietor, or sometimes called a single member LLC, disregarded entity, Schedule C, that means that you are going to be filing your business income and expenses on the Schedule C of your personal tax return. If you're a sole proprietor, that means at the end of the year, you only file one tax return, your personal tax return. It's going to obviously have other personal stuff, mortgage interest, dependents, but your tax return for your business is all included in one. This is fairly easy because if you are a sole proprietor, Schedule C, there is only one way to pay yourself, and that is distribution. If you are a sole proprietor, you do not want to go on payroll. You're actually not allowed to go on payroll. Now, if you are on payroll and you're sole proprietor, is it the end of the world? No, not really. We'll talk about that in a second. But the IRS does not want you to do this. So essentially, the way that it works for a sole proprietor is whatever your net income is treated more or less like your wages. So everyone is kind of familiar with how taxes work in maybe not the finer details, but the broad strokes of this. Net income, you pay tax on net income. We pay different tax rates depending on what it is. But let's say that you're a sole proprietor and your net income after depreciation, everything is $60,000. And so you're going to see $60,000 on your Schedule C on your tax return. So the way the sole proprietor works is because you don't actually take payroll out of these, all of your profit is deemed as payroll, more or less. So if you have $60,000 in profit, you're going to pay income tax on that $60,000. So let's just use a rough number of about 20% there. So on that $60,000, you're going to pay around $12,000 in income tax. Now, look at your paycheck, right? If you work for someone else, if you work for yourself, on your paycheck, your net wages are not just reduced by your income tax withholding. You also have Social Security and Medicare. Now, since a sole proprietor or Schedule C does not actually pay themselves on payroll, you pay what's called self-employment tax on top of the income tax. So self-employment tax is an extra 15% tax added on to the top for sole proprietors. So essentially, if you make $60,000 in profit, you're going to pay around $12,000 in income tax plus another $9,000 in self-employment tax. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, Hunt, that's a lot of money, which is true. I'm not going to argue with that. But more or less, the kind of taxes that you pay would look virtually identical if you were to take $60,000 all out in the form of wages. If you're a sole proprietor, it's easy. Whatever you make, whatever your net income is, that's what you're going to pay tax on, including self-employment tax. Now, distributions for a sole proprietor don't have any effect on this. And you'll actually see later on, distributions never have an effect really on taxes. So let's say that your business made $60,000 in profit and you took all of that out in distributions. You're going to pay around $20,000 in tax, right? Just like we talked about before. Now, let's say you made $60,000 in profit and you left it all in your business. You didn't take out any of it in the form of distributions. Again, you're still going to pay the same amount in tax. You pay tax on net income. Doesn't matter if you keep that money in the business or you take that money out. And that rule is the same for a sole proprietor. That rule is the same for partnerships. And that rule is the exact same for S corporations. You pay tax on profit, not on distributions. Two completely separate things. Now, where this gets a little bit tricky sometimes is people are like, so I don't pay tax on distributions? And I always have to say, no, but a lot of times you do anyways. What the heck do you mean by that? You pay tax on net income, not distributions. But a distribution is a distribution of profit. How could you have any money to distribute to yourself if you're not making any profit? That's what I mean by you don't actually pay money on the distributions themselves, but a lot of times you probably made the same amount of money. If your profit is zero, your distributions are going to be zero. If your distributions are 30 grand, you probably made at least 30 grand in profit in order to take that money out. To wrap it up, as far as paying yourself, sole proprietor, you're not going on wages. You can take whatever money out that you would like. Obviously, you can't take out more than you make in profit because you wouldn't have the cash. If we're going from a sole proprietor, the next step would be probably a partnership. Partnership is generally an LLC that has more than one member. So 2, 4, 35, whatever it has, you have more than one member that owns that LLC. This is almost exactly the same as a sole proprietor. So a partnership is going to file a separate tax return, a partnership return, 1065 return is what they're called. And just like a sole proprietor, you are going to pay not only income tax, but self-employment tax on your portion of wages or your portion of profit. So let's say that you own a business, you have a partner, you guys are 50-50, and the business makes $120,000 in profit. If the ownership percentage is 50-50, then one partner is going to pay his share of tax on 60 grand, the other person's going to pay their share of tax on 60 grand as well. Now, if it's a different ownership percentage, then obviously the income flows differently to partners. And for a partnership, you can really change that however you want. You could still say, hey, I still own 50%, you own 50%, but this year I'm going to let you have all of the income, or I'm going to let you have all of the losses. You can really do a lot of different flexible things with partnerships, but what you cannot do, just like a sole proprietor, is you cannot take out any wages. Partnership, sole proprietor, not supposed to be on payroll. Again, if you are, if you're thinking to yourself, oh my God, am I going to get in huge trouble? No, but you should talk to your accountant, because if you're already on payroll and you are a partnership or a sole proprietor, it might make sense to switch, and honestly, to switch to an S corporation. We already talked about a sole proprietor, no payroll, just distributions. Partnership, same exact rules. Do not put yourself on payroll, just distributions. Most of these questions come up because most people are actually taxed as S corporations. I would say of all of our shops that we do, 90% or more are S corporations. In this day and age, it is the most common and probably for most people, the most favorable way to be taxed if you're a small business. And this is where this comes in. If you're an S corporation, you are allowed to take out as much distributions as you would like. Obviously, you can't take out more than you made because that's not possible. If, big if here, right? You are paying yourself a fair and reasonable salary. This is where a lot of the confusion comes in. Hunt, what is a fair and reasonable salary? It is a very subjective answer. And my answer back to you is, yeah, exactly. There is, and I've signed up for these before, continuing education tax courses talking about how do you calculate fair market value wages. The general consensus is, and even the IRS will more or less admit this, hey, we get it subjective. You need to have reasonable cause of how you came up with this number. Also, as far as concerns about fair and reasonable wages, there's really never been many tax cases at all that come back and say, hey, Hunt was paying himself $70,000 a year. IRS audited him and said he should have been paying himself $90,000 or $50,000. Every single tax case on S-Corp owners' compensation all had to do with people that were literally taking zero, right? Like the famous one, I guess you wouldn't know who the heck is going to know famous tax cases other than an accountant. But the big one that gets talked about a lot was there was a guy that I think he owned like an ice cream truck down at the shore or something. And he made $500,000 in profit and paid himself zero wages. And for whatever reason, decided to die on that hill that he did not actually have to take any wages, yada, yada, yada. IRS didn't like that. And it's just silly. If this guy would have taken 50 grand in wages, he never would have got audited, never would have had to pay 50 hundreds of thousands of dollars to take this to tax court. But hey, the ice cream man wanted to fight, and a fight is what he got, and he lost. So the way that it works for shops, knowing that the IRS doesn't have much of an opinion on what that fair and reasonable wage is, as long as it is out there, then we kind of move to something else. We know that the IRS wants us to have a fair and reasonable wage, but they're not super picky about what it is. Then let's argue whatever's going to be the best for us, right? Why are we going to argue something that is going to hurt us if the IRS, we know, doesn't really look into this or care in that level of detail? We need to take a look at how these two are taxed. So let's use that example of an S corporation. And let's say that this S corporation is making $120,000 in profit. Now, if they took all of the $120,000 out in the form of payroll, they would end up having zero on their S corporation as far as profit, and they would be paying income tax on all their wages as well as payroll tax. So the big savings here is not actually the income tax, because whether it's coming from the S corp or payroll, we're both going to pay income tax. Now, not to make this more confusing, S corporation income is taxed slightly lower than regular wages, but for argument's sake right now, let's just say that they're taxed the same. Whether I have $120,000 of business income, $120,000 of W-2, income tax-wise, exactly the same. But why do we care? The reason we care is payroll taxes. Payroll taxes are generally paid half by the employee, half by the employer, but if you're self-employed, you are both of those parties. You add those two amounts together, it works out to be just under 15%. Very similar to self-employment tax, right? It's supposed to be the replacement for payroll tax. So if we're taking $120,000 out on payroll, we are going to end up paying around $18,000 or so in payroll taxes. If we're trying to minimize that, but we know we can't have an unreasonably low amount on payroll, what is the magic number? Magic number for shops is generally about $65,000 a year. Now, it doesn't need to be exactly 65. Could it be 60? Could it be 70? Could it be 75? Yeah, in that ballpark is fine. The reason why we like that number is for a couple reasons. First and foremost, we need to have a fair and reasonable wage. $60,000, $70,000, you could argue up and down, hey, look, this other person in my shop makes that a year, and that's more or less what my official job responsibility is. Again, could the IRS come in and say you're underpaid, overpaid, or something? Yeah, but they're not going to, right? That is enough money on there. They're getting a decent amount in payroll tax. But if you can look at it right there, just doing that math, let's say instead of putting all of our profit on payroll, we only do half of it or $60,000. That alone is going to save us $9,000 in payroll taxes. Huge. If you were to look at two tax returns side by side, both S corporations, both make $120,000 in profit. One person decided to take out 120 grand in wages. The other person only took out 60 in wages and the rest of it in distributions. The person that did 50-50 on wages and distributions is going to pay $9,000 less in tax in a year, right? This is the ideal situation for tax planning. This is literally doing some paperwork and saving money on it. So what I always tell people is $60,000, $70,000 is the sweet spot. Even as your profits improve, as they increase on it, hey, if you took $60,000 out in payroll and you took $400,000 out in distributions, it's all good. IRS says you can take out whatever you want as long as you're paying yourself a fair and reasonable amount on payroll. NapaTrax has made selecting the right shop management system easy by offering the industry's best, most comprehensive SMS. It all starts when a local representative meets with you to learn about your business and how you need to run it. After all, it's your shop, so it's your choice, and having a local representation is a huge plus. Customizing tracks to your business, whether you're a one-person shop or a large multi-bay or multi-location company, our representative consults with you to help optimize your shop's workflow, efficiency, and profitability. And unlike the other guys, we'll be there for you after installation with the best training and support in the business, with a learning management system tailored to each role in your company. Simply put, Trax was designed and built for shop owners just like you. Visit us on the web at napatrax.com. That's NAPATRACS.com. Are you tired of spending endless hours searching for the perfect talent to join your team? Promotive is your full-service automotive staffing solution. At Promotive, we believe in being more than just a recruiting agency. We become an extension of your team, working tirelessly to ensure we place the right talent with the right shops. With our always be recruiting mindset, we're constantly seeking out the best professionals in the industry. We manage 90 to 95% of the recruiting process, taking the burden off your shoulders. When you partner with Promotive, you gain a dedicated recruiter and account manager who will work closely with you, understanding your unique requirements and seeking out candidates who fit seamlessly into your shop's culture. We'll ensure that every candidate we present is thoroughly vetted and aligned with your needs. With Promotive, you'll have a peace of mind knowing that we're handling the recruitment process with expertise and precision. We don't just match resumes, we match character, culture, and long-term success. Visit our website at gopromotive.com today and experience the power of Promotive's expertise and dedication. Together, we'll build a stronger and more successful team. There's one other aspect that I want to talk about there that, like I said, was from another email, but let's talk finally, because remember there was four, right? We had sole proprietor, Schedule Cs, no payroll, all distributions. Partnerships, same thing, no payroll, all distributions. S corporation, you want to have some on payroll, the rest on distributions. How much on payroll? Probably around 70 grand. Now, last one on here is a C corporation. C corporations are pretty rare. Probably only a small percentage of people listening to this are actually a C corporation. You can take a distribution, or it would be called a dividend if you're taken out of a C corp. Most people do not do those. The reason why you wouldn't want to take them out of a C corporation is, unlike an S corporation, you make money, you pay tax on it, and you can do whatever you want with the cash. For a C corporation, you pay tax on the corporate level, and then if you take a dividend, it's going to get taxed again personally. It's double taxation. No one wants to do that. So generally, for a C corporation to get money out of the business, you're going to take a much higher salary than an S corporation. That's virtually the only way that you can get money out of a C corp. Wages, bonusing yourself. If you rent from yourself, you can play around with your rent money, but you're not taking distributions out. As a quick little follow-up on that one before we move to the next question, that idea of fair and market value salary, how much to take out in distributions, and a bunch of variations is so common. The only other aspect, and someone else asked about Social Security, because they were in that situation. They were taking out over 100 grand in wages, and they said, Hunt, if I lower my wages down to $60,000, isn't that going to negatively affect my Social Security? And the answer is yes, but do you actually care? As you pay in to Social Security up to about $130,000 in payroll, you're going to increase your future Social Security benefits. The way that your Social Security benefits are calculated when you retire is they take your highest 35 years of earnings. So if you have one bad year, it's not going to mess up your Social Security benefits, right? 35 years is a monstrous average. But if you have an average of 100 grand or you have an average of 60 grand over those 35 years, obviously that's going to make a difference for your benefits down the road. Now, the reason I said, do you actually care? The reason why we like $65,000, $70,000 on wages is, yeah, as we pay ourselves more over and above that mark, we are going to be paying more into Social Security, but the amount of money that we're going to get back in a future date starts to significantly decline once you get past that number. Like when you first start paying into Social Security, like 0 to 30 grand in wages, you might get 1 to 1. Hey, every dollar I put into Social Security, I'm going to get that same money back when I retire. Now, then it might be 2 to 1 from 30,000 to 70 grand. Hey, every $2 I put in, I'm going to get back a dollar later. Still not the worst return on investment. And also, like I said, we're trying to check the box of fair and reasonable salary. However, once you start getting above that, you're starting into 80, 90, 100, 110,000. Every dollar that you're putting in and contributing for Social Security, you're getting less and less back as future benefit. So your return on investment really starts to drop back. So even though I said, yeah, if you take out less in salary, your future benefits are going to be reduced, it's probably not great bang for your buck. If your average wages are $60,000, is your benefit going to be twice as much if your average was 120 grand? No, it's not the same return on investment. So if your average wage base is 120 versus 60, you might be getting 20, 25% more, even though you paid in twice as much Social Security. So to wrap all that up, Schedule C, no payroll, just distributions. Partnership, no payroll, just distributions. S-Corp, probably around 65, 70 grand on wages, rest distributions, more or less unlimited. C-Corporation, opposite. All on payroll, and like I said, if you want, you can play around with it. A little bit of money coming out when rent, if you rent from yourself. Do not take a dividend out of a C-Corporation before consulting with your accountant. So that was a little bit of a long one, but like I said, it's the most common one, so I wanted to make sure we covered all of our bases. So let's go down through a couple of these other ones here and see what we got. Next one comes from Jim in Florida. And this is a little bit of an easy one, but this question and also a slight variation to it are pretty common as well. Hi, Hunt. I was listening to another great episode of Business by the Numbers on succession planning. My plan is to sell my shop at 80% of fair market value to one of my 7 children, hold the note likely interest-free for 10 years getting monthly payments. If I did this as a stock sale to make it easier, would my son be able to write off the payments and me be able to pay tax on payments as capital gains? Thanks, Jim in Florida. So Jim is looking to sell his shop at 80% of fair market value to one of his kids. And he's going to hold the note on it. And he was wondering if his son would be able to write off those payments and he would be able to pay tax as capital gains as he receives it. So to unpack this one a little bit, he has one of these right and one of these wrong. So if you sell the stock of your business to a kid, any money that the kid gives you is going to be recognized as capital gains on your taxes. Just like if you were to sell any stock, it is taxed very, very, very favorably for you as a seller. Now, some people like to do this because Jim said it is easier. You can keep the same entity, same QuickBooks, same federal ID number. Really nothing changes. And like I said, it's taxed very well for the seller. Now, why we generally do not like to see stock sales is his son, in this case, would get absolutely no write-off. I don't think Jim ever told me the amount of money that we're talking about here, but let's say that he ended up paying his dad back $500,000. None of that would be a write-off for Jim's son until he sells that business in the future. Payment of stock is not actually a tax write-off. It is going to go against what he sells that business for. But in a case like a small business like this, it might not be the best idea because I imagine that he wants and expects his son to take over and run that for a long time. So even though he is going to get a write-off for that 500 grand, it might not be for 10 or 20 more years. Another thing that I wanted to mention on this is what are the alternatives and also a question about valuations here. If I was to come back and they would say, Hunt, what would you recommend doing? I would say do not do a stock sale. I would do an asset sale. Make your son go out, set up his own LLC, and buy the assets of your business from you. Majority of this is still going to be capital gains because majority of what he's buying from you is still going to be goodwill, which is all capital gains, but some of it is going to be equipment. What you're going to end up having there by switching this over to an asset sale is you're going to have slightly worse tax treatment for dad as the seller, but still pretty much unchanged. It might go up by a couple percentage points, not really that much. However, for the son, that turns all of this stuff into a deduction. Now, some of this gets depreciated faster, like the equipment we can write off in the first year versus the goodwill we have to write off over 15. But at the end of the day, we will be end up able to write off the entire amount of this. You can still operate under the same business name, even though the corporate name will be different. What I always tell people is, hey, a little bit of money, a little bit of time up front to do this as a asset sale instead of a stock sale is really, really going to benefit the buyer. Now, if you're the seller and you don't care, you just want to be taxed the easiest, quickest, best way, you can do a stock sale. But you probably don't want to put your kid or other key employee in a bad spot either. Now, the last aspect of that has to do with selling it at 80% of fair market value. I get this question a lot. Hey, I want to sell my business to XYZ, and someone told me I have to have a valuation done, or the IRS could come in and say, hey, you sold that at a discounted rate. So what I always tell people is it really depends. If you are selling your business and you think it's worth $800,000 and you have an unrelated person you're selling it to, whether it's a key employee, longtime employee, outside person, friend, you name it, if it's not a family member, I really doubt that anyone will ever question this, right? You have two unrelated parties. They gave one another $400,000 for these assets, then hey, they've kind of set fair market value. The IRS is not going to come in and do their own valuation and say, hey, that was supposed to be $600,000 and you only sold it for $400,000. Now, if you had a commercial building that was worth $12 million and you sold it to a quote unquote unrelated person for $400,000, yeah, of course, it's ridiculous. But most of these are not that big of numbers. So unrelated person, even if you think that that person's getting a deal, you don't really actually have to justify this for any given reason. Unrelated parties, arm's length transaction, IRS is going to say, hey, you just set the market. You showed us what the value was. Now, if you're selling it to your kid, this can get a little bit tricky because obviously the IRS knows that there's a possibility that you might not be selling it at fair market value. If you're talking about Jim where he's saying, hey, I'm selling it what I feel like is 80% of fair market value to the kids, no one's ever going to blink an eye, right? Hey, instead of selling to him, little Johnny for $1 million, you sold it for $800,000. Again, there's intricacies here that probably just aren't going to make any difference. Now, if you are trying to just give your business to a kid or pay a comically small amount, it depends on how aggressive you want to be. Realistically, it's still probably never going to be looked into, but if you want to keep everything above board and make sure that there's no issues down the road, especially if you have like custody issues, an ex-wife that might challenge this, kid could cause a stink after you were to pass away. The official way to do these is to do a full valuation and do a gift tax return. Now, it does cost a decent bit of money to do this officially, but there is no gift tax actually paid. So let's say I had a business that was worth $2 million and I wanted to gift it to one of my daughters. I would have to go out and pay someone to do a valuation, pay for them to do a gift tax return, but there's not actually going to be any tax associated with me transferring that to my daughter. I have to report it. I have to tell the government about this, but our lifetime exemption is about $11 million that we're allowed to gift or not have hit with gift tax or estate tax. So even though we're doing it officially, we're spending some money, we're still not paying any tax on this. Now, the reason why the IRS generally doesn't get involved in these is if someone is selling to someone for less than fair market value, the government's not really losing anything because that person is going to get a lower deduction. I'm going to pay less tax on gain. If I were to sell it for more, they're going to get a bigger deduction. I'm going to pay more on gain. There's kind of a two sides to this. So whether it's higher or lower, they're losing on one side, winning on another. It's just really not looked into that much. Big thing there is, like I said, generally try to do an asset sale and don't worry about valuations if you guys are kind of in the ballpark of something that kind of smells legitimate. If you want to get a valuation done, great. But hey, if you two sit down and you say, this is worth $400,000, we're good to go with it. No need to get me or anyone else involved. You guys have set the value and set the market. We got two last ones on here. One of these we've talked about before. The last one I wanted to put in here because I've never really done an episode on this and I'm not really going to get in much detail, but more of a, hey, FYI, make sure that you're doing this stuff correctly. The next one comes from Andrew up north in Canada. Andrew says, I have started listening to your podcast the last month or so. I'm currently a technician contemplating opening a shop in the future. In your last episode, you made a reference to accrual and cash accounting in a shop. I was wondering if you could unpack that a little bit as what that looks like practically in an auto shop and pros and cons of the two methods. I'm really enjoying the show. Sincerely, Andrew in Canada. I talk about this a lot, cash basis accrual. And this is a super common question from shop owners. A lot of times you might hear this from a coaching company. Hey, I need to make sure that my books are done in accrual basis. And half those people, it's what is already going on. And so what that really means is a lot of people hear about this and they say, hey, I want to be accrual, but most people don't know it because, like I said, a lot of you guys, most of you, if you're one of our clients, you're already on accrual basis to a certain extent. Accrual can kind of be infinite on it. And if you want to get into the really, really fine details, you're probably not going to see that on most shops' books. But the general idea is this. So cash basis is, think about it as literally old school paper cash, right? That they're trying to ban now. That's the way that the accounting works. Hey, unless I have cash in my hand, it's not a sale. Unless I have cash going out of my pocket and paying someone, it is not an expense. The timing of this is what we're talking about, right? The expenses are still the same for accrual versus cash basis. It's just when we recognize it. So cash basis means, hey, if I sold all of this work, but no one paid me, I didn't have any sale, right? It's only when I actually deposit that cash in my bank account that I recognize it as a sale. So I do a big job in January. I don't get paid until March. I'm not going to recognize anything in January. And whenever I deposit that money in March is when it's going to be counted as a sale. On the expense side, it's the exact same way. Hey, I had a big NAPA bill from January. I ended up paying that NAPA bill in February. There is going to be no sort of deduction in January because we didn't pay anything yet. And in February, when we actually write that check to NAPA, that's when we're going to take the expense on it. So the timing on this has nothing to do when it is earned or incurred, but actually when it is either received or paid out. Now, we do not like to do books on cash basis because the most accurate way of looking at your financials more or less has nothing to do with when you're paying this, but actually when it's incurred. So like for that NAPA bill, why would we want to look at that as a February expense when all of what we're paying are January invoices for our parts? So instead of recognizing that $10,000 payment to NAPA in February when we actually pay it out, we are actually going to create a bill or accrue that in January so that we have that parts cost reflected in January. We want that to be accrual basis because we want those expenses to match up when our, you know, when the work was actually being done. Now, if we're only recognizing the cost in the correct period, we still have an issue with sales if we're not doing sales on accrual basis as well. Now, sales on accrual basis for most shops means having to do accounts receivable. Let's say that, like we said before, we had that big job in January and it wasn't paid until March. On cash basis, we wouldn't see anything until we see that deposit in March. However, if we're going to go to accrual basis, we would post that sale in January and close it out to accounts receivable. Hey, we had a $30,000 sale in January. That's when I paid the parts. That's where my parts bills are going to match up to. That's when I paid my technician, my overhead, and everything. So we're going to have that $30,000 as a sale in January. If that gets paid in January or February or December, it doesn't matter because we're all going to have that in receivables. And so by moving over to accrual basis, we are going to smooth out some of these swings that happen with cash inflows and outflows and match up the expenses and income to the period that they are earned, incurred, or actually completed. Cash has to do with timing of deposits or timing of paid out. Now, like I said before, if you're one of my clients, you are already doing your books this way. What level of detail you want to get into this is really up to you. True accrual basis would mean going down to the hour. Hey, I paid this guy $800. Now, $225 really should be on this period. The other $650 is going to be in next period. Don't go overboard on this stuff, right? It'll make you go crazy. Generally, for accrual basis, we are 100% dead on for sales. Sales should never have any difference on it. For parts cost, generally, we will accrue the major vendors on this. 90-95% of most shops' business comes from three vendors or less. The big boys that you have credit terms with, we will accrue those expenses. Now, for stuff like a cell phone bill or utilities, yeah, you're always going to be paying that bill probably the following month, but it's probably either exactly the same or a very similar amount every single month. So whether I'm paying $300 for September or $300 for October, I don't really care that much as long as I only have one payment in each month. So don't go crazy on this stuff because you'll end up just wasting a ton of time and not actually getting any added benefit. But make sure that the big boys, the big kind of variables are captured correctly and captured in the correct period. All right. So last one on here, and we will wrap this thing up. And like I said, thank you for sending these questions in. I hope that they've been helpful for you guys, and maybe it gave you a little bit of encouragement to send me in your own questions as well. So last one on here comes from Joe in Pennsylvania. So that is two votes for Pennsylvania. Half of our questions came from PA. So good work up there, guys. Hunt, I have a great topic. Paying overtime on discretionary and non-discretionary bonuses for hourly workers. If you look online, there is no calculators to do this. I did make my own in Excel. It's fairly simple, but most people do not do it. I guarantee you, I've talked to this in several 20 groups and about half the room raises their hand and they don't know it's the law. It'd be great if you could talk about it or even possibly post some type of calculator for people to do it. Joe in PA. So I think when Joe sent me this, this one is actually a little bit older than these other ones. I think I might have mentioned this on a podcast before, but to answer Joe's question, no, I'm not going to put a calculator on here. The reason I'm going to discuss this is to just kind of put an idea in your head. I'm not going to tell you that you're doing overtime wrong. I'm not going to tell you that you're doing overtime right, but I'm going to tell you what Joe is meaning here and why so many shop owners are confused by this. If you are paying your people overtime or you're not paying your overtime, I'm going to guess that half of you are doing it wrong. It is inevitably one of the trickier things to do. Now, the good news about it is even if you're doing it wrong, most people, if you look in a grand scheme of it, you're actually paying it correctly. But if the state came and looked, they would have said, hey, you should have given them more here, less of them there. In the overall scheme, it should kind of work out in the long run. But what this has to do with is discretionary bonuses for hourly workers, right? Versus non-discretionary bonuses and how that gets taken into consideration for overtime. So let's say that you have a service advisor and his base pay is $20 an hour, right? So his base pay is $20 an hour and he works 40 hours in a week. He will get $800 as gross pay. Now, like a lot of people, this person has a commission plan. So he is a service advisor, and as long as he hits $30,000 a week in sales, he gets an extra $800. If we hit over $30,000 in sales, his check is going to be $1,600, not $800. If you hit less than $30,000 in sales, no commission, no bonus, you just get your $800 base hourly rate. We know that without any of the commission or bonuses, his hourly rate is $20 an hour. So what Joe is talking about here is a lot of people ignore that bonus amount, right? Because they say, hey, that's not his hourly rate. That's commission. That has nothing to do with his hourly rate. So if this service advisor was to get overtime hours, most people would say, all right, this person makes time and a half, and I'm going to need to pay him 1.5 times his hourly rate, which would be $30 an hour, right? Regular rate would be $20 an hour. Overtime rate would be $30 an hour. What Joe knows and what a lot of people don't know is this person's overtime rate, assuming that they've been hitting these bonuses every single week or majority of the time, this person's overtime rate is actually not $30 an hour. It's actually $60 an hour. What? Are you kidding me? No, I am dead serious. And now I will put this out there that overtime rules, some of this is dictated on the federal level. Some of this is done on the state level. And this can get a little bit tricky. And for a lot of you guys have different pay plans, so you don't even pay overtime whatsoever. So you don't even have to worry about this. If you are paying overtime, just keep this into consideration. Think about this. Do your own research to a certain extent. So the way that this works is the Department of Labor looks at discretionary and non-discretionary bonuses completely different. Let's say that randomly I just decide to give my service advisor $800 bonus when I feel like it. That is what we call a discretionary bonus. There is no set terms. I feel like giving him one, I give him one. I don't feel like giving him one, I don't. In that situation, his overtime rate would be $30 an hour because that bonus would not be factored in to his base rate. However, this pay plan that we have set up here is called a non-discretionary bonus. There is set terms, there is set gates, there are set requirements, and if he meets those requirements, there's no discretion on my behalf. If he meets those requirements, he's going to get his bonus. So what the Department of Labor says in this case is non-discretionary bonuses need to be factored in when you do your overtime calculation. So what they would do is they would say, all right, you had $800 in hourly wages plus $800 on non-discretionary bonuses, divide that by 40 hours, and you end up with an effective hourly rate of $40 an hour. Now, generally, and this is where it kind of gets different on state by states, some people go the trailing 4 weeks, some of them go trailing 4 months, 6 months. What time period you have to use to come up with the average is all slightly different. Let's just say this person was getting it like clockwork to have simple math. We know now his effective hourly rate is $40 an hour once we factor in the bonuses. So if he gets overtime, it would be time and a half on 40, not time and a half on 20. And that's where this ends up out, that this person will actually be getting overtime at a rate of $60 an hour, not $30 an hour. Now, the reason I bring this up, like I said, is I am not an employment law advisor. I'm not a employment lawyer, any of this stuff, right? This can get very complicated, and overtime is something that gets very, very tricky. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, Hunt, should I pay overtime? Should I not pay overtime? I always err on the side of paying overtime. It is something that if you do not pay it and you get caught, it can be very bad. If you're in California, be very, 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 very careful with overtime. I cannot stretch that enough. I probably didn't even put enough varies in there. If I said the last five clients that got overtime lawsuits, judgments, state looked into it, I'm going to say all five of those were in California. It's one of the strictest places for overtimes. For whatever reason, it seems to be the easiest one for a disgruntled employee to either hire a lawyer or report you to the state, and they will actually come out and look into this. So this is not somewhere to get aggressive. This is not somewhere to try to play funny games on it. If someone has overtime, pay them overtime. Make sure that it shows overtime on their paycheck, right? Don't try to say, hey, I'll give you a bonus, which is kind of your overtime. If that person worked more than 40 hours, they're going to look for an overtime line on their paycheck. If they don't see it, you're going to get in trouble. It doesn't matter that the commission is more than the overtime. It doesn't matter that you gave them cash and actually gave them more money. No overtime on that pay stub, big issue, right? So proceed with caution on this, guys. Use your best judgment on this. And like I said, if you are in this situation, then hey, maybe you need to update your calculations. Really, for most people, it's probably not a major issue. If you have someone that is working 20, 30 hours a week on overtime, you probably need to get another person on it. And if you do have it and you're concerned about this stuff, then hey, maybe you need to modify the pay plan. If they make enough money and if they have enough power on that, maybe you can go have them go to salary where they're actually exempt from overtime. There are a number of different things here. Just make sure to look into this stuff. Last thing on overtime is if you do consistently pay overtime, I really recommend doing weekly payroll. If you do biweekly payroll or semi-monthly payroll with overtime, it can actually be a logistical nightmare. The easy part about a weekly payroll is you're always comparing it to 40 hours. If you're doing biweekly or semi-monthly, it can get really tricky, right? So let's say that you pay every other Friday and you're looking at the person's stub and he worked 80 hours. You're thinking to yourself, no overtime, right? 80 hours in a period, he worked 80 hours. Now, if that person worked 80 hours week one and 0 hours week two, you would actually owe them 40 hours of regular pay and 40 hours of overtime. Overtime rules go by the week, not the pay period. Now, biweekly still makes it a little bit easier because you have two distinct weeks that kind of cut those off. The semi-monthly and stuff like that get tricky because you might have a floating day where you actually have to use it in the next week's calculations. It can get really complicated. So if you are doing overtime, you probably already do this on a weekly basis anyways. But if you're pulling your hair out, trying to calculate overtime and you're not doing weekly, save yourself some headaches. And probably the best thing to do would be to switch that pay plan to a weekly basis just to make your calculations easier and make sure that you're not getting yourself into trouble. That brings us to the end of our mailbox episode. Hopefully that answered all of your questions. And obviously, thanks again to Joe, Andrew, Jim, Alex, and anyone else that sent in wonderful questions. I love to hear the feedback. I love to be able to give back and help you guys. And like I said, if you guys are wondering, there's probably someone else out there listening that is wondering the same thing. So keep them coming. As always, please share this with friends. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future episodes, please shoot me an email at podcast@parmelis.com. Just want to say thanks again for listening on the Aftermarket Radio Network. You can find all shows on the aftermarketradionetwork.com and on your favorite podcast listening apps. Thanks again for joining me on Business by the Numbers. Stay safe out there, and I will talk to you all next week.
You've been listening to Business by the Numbers with Hunt Demarest on the Aftermarket Radio Network. Follow Hunt on your favorite podcast listening app. Let him know what you'd like him to cover. His email is in the show notes. Hunt is all for advancing the aftermarket.